We also see from this letter that the value of these textiles, and it's hard to gauge what the value of work was in antiquity. So we use these specifics, a half mina for a textile that is 9 cubits long and 8 cubits wide, can help us try and work out what the value of work was considered. It's still a pretty difficult process. We see from these letters that women emerge as very active partners in trade, as weavers, as the leaders of the household in Assur, and as negotiators with other merchants. So women really are the representatives of their husbands while they are away. And this connects very well with the evidence we got from Nuzi, where we saw that widows, for example, could establish negotiations for marriage or be involved in legal cases if there was no male representative alive for them. Then the woman would do it. The same situation occurs in Assur. We have letters from women who wrangled with Assyrian tax officials on behalf of their husbands, who represented their husbands' interests in legal cases, and even paid off their debts. So these Assyrian wives who were married to merchants were obviously very independent women who could govern the household in the absence of their husbands and probably many other male members of their family. We also learn from the letters that traders could disappear, perhaps intentionally on some occasions, if they wanted to default on a loan or saw an attractive Anatolian woman that they preferred to their nagging wife who was constantly asking them for money. They could also fall victim to crime or accident. But with the lack of communication, or the difficulty of communication, I should say, it's hard for the families to stay in touch. The evidence from Karum Kinesh is important because we see what we would call today private enterprise, in contrast to the state-run economy that has been the focus of our investigation of trade so far. Although the political structure of Assur is poorly attested for this period of the Kinesh merchants, we do get an early hint of Assur's later prominence about a century after the Kinesh texts, in the early 18th century, with the rise of Shamshi Adad to the throne of Assur. As with many successful military rulers, we know little about Shamshi Adad's origins, although we do know that he was not from Assur, but rather from another city on the Tigris, Ekalatum. This city has not yet been discovered, so we're not exactly sure where it is. Shamshi Adad appears in the text after he conquered Assur and takes the throne in 1808 BC. Assur was at this time probably still a very important mercantile center, and this focus and emphasis on trade may have been the reason that Shamshi Adad moved west against the city of Mari on the Euphrates River, and he established control of this rich trading center. Shamshi Adad would control an impressive amount of territory in northern Mesopotamia during his reign, about 1,200 miles from the Tigris to Anatolia. And so, even though this political history is a little confused, we start to see that large powers, large regional states will become the norm, and we'll discuss this in more detail in the next few lectures. Shamshi Adad set his two sons, Ishmael Dagan and Yasma Adad, on the throne of the cities to the east and west, respectively. Yasma Adad's activities as the ruler of Mari are documented in the archives of that city. You might remember I mentioned that his father had written him telling him how to collect ice. And I also mentioned that Yasma Adad was someone who was very concerned with providing a good and rich diet for himself. We will see that he's not a very good ruler, perhaps because of this tendency towards self-indulgence. We'll discuss both of these rulers, Shamshi Adad and Yasma Adad, in connection with Hammurabi and the city of Mari.